Have you ever loved someone so much that you followed them around and talked endlessly about them to all your friends and family? That's how much we love rhododendron, a quirky and amazing genus of flowering plants with a deep human history and an incredible ecological legacy. Follow along on our adventures as we learn about the remarkable things that folks all around the world have done for the love of rhododendron. Episode 4, Where Kindred Spirits Convene. In this episode, we meet some of the organizers and speakers from the upcoming American Rhododendron Society Fall Convention. They share their fascinating rhododendron origin stories, the important work they are currently doing in rhododendron, and give a tantalizing preview of the virtual convention lineup. Though our friends and families may tire of hearing about rhododendron, as Lucy Maud Montgomery reminds us in Anne of Green Gables, kindred spirits are not so scarce as I used to think. It's splendid to find out there are so many of them in the world.
Hello, everyone. It's terrific to have you join us today on this Next Gen podcast. I'm Christina Woodward, and I'm co-hosting this session with Juliana Medeiros. Hello, Juliana. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
And a warm welcome to our guest, Glenn Jameson. Glenn, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm the editor of the Journal of the American Rhododendron Society, commonly referred to as JARS. I'm also the District 1 director. And for those of you that may not realize it, but all the members in the American Rhododendron Society are broken up into regional districts. And British Columbia is District 1. California and Hawaii, for example, are District 5. And I'm also past president, well, will be in a few weeks, of the Mount Arrowsmith Rhododendron chapter located here in Parksville in central Vancouver Island. So at the moment, I'm wearing sort of three hats, but soon to be two. I'll be past president as of September 1st.
Well, you do have a lot to share with us, Glenn, and we're really interested in asking you a few questions. We'd like to sort of go over what the overall role in the ARS, and you have described some of it, but how long have you been involved with the organization?
So I joined the American Rhododendron Society, the Mount Arrowsmith chapter, in 1995, so it's about 26 years now. I became editor of JARS in 2009, so that's about 12 years, and I've been actively involved with the different chapters on the island, as I've been program chair for Mount Arrowsmith for quite a few years now.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about JARS, which translates to Journal of the American Rhododendron Society.
Right. JARS is somewhat of a unique publication because most gardening societies have newsletters or maybe one publication a year. But JARS, the American Rhododendron Society, has JARS, which has four issues a year. The only one that probably exceeds that is the Royal Horticultural Society, The Garden, which has monthly publications. But the challenge for me, at least, is that the ARS does not pay for any articles, whereas many the RHS does. So a big part of my job is soliciting material to put in JARS. And the challenge here is that I need to have representation of the three major groups, the hardy rhododendrons, the elepidotes, the azaleas, and the viraeas. So I try in each issue to get a little bit of each of those topics. I also have to try and get geographical representation because we have chapters in Europe and North America on both coasts, and of course in Hawaii. And we have individual members who belong outside that in Australia, New Zealand, different countries in Europe where there aren't chapters. So I try to get a regional representation, a species representation, and then I try to get different topics. So sometimes exploration, sometimes research articles, sometimes culture articles. So trying to blend all these things together into an issue. And it's fun producing it.
Well, I'm an avid reader of the journal, and I know the variety that is in it. There's something for everyone in every issue.
And we'll have some links on our page, so we'll put a link to that.
Yeah, that's good.
Wonderful. In addition to all of your work with the jars, you are also running a conference coming up in October. So can you tell us the who, what, when, where of the conference?
So it's going to be held on October 23rd, 24th. It's going to be 4 hours each day. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And we have topics that range from four topics each day. The first one is Szechuan, a plants in paradise by Hartwig Schepker in Germany. And that's the exploration part of the talk. Then we have Shannon Birch, who's going to talk on your living soil, but the microbes and fungi that live in the soil that really benefit plant propagation. Then we have a talk about how rhododendrons relate to rock gardening, the smaller plants and how they can be used in rock gardens by David Seller, who's from past involvement with the Alpine Society in British Columbia. And then A Walk in the Woods by Don Hyatt about azaleas in the eastern part of the USA in the Appalachian Mountains. On Sunday, we have a talk by David Milas from UK on conservation of heritage rhododendrons, work they're doing in England in that area. Then a talk by Linda Chalker-Scott on mulch, which is really important for successful growth of rhododendrons, called The Good, the Bad, and the Just Plain Ugly, and the importance of mulch, the different types of mulch, how to use mulch, and so on. Then we have a talk by Richard Dion from Quebec on growing rhododendrons in Quebec's harsh winters, the challenges in growing plants in a harsh environment. So this is particularly relevant to people in northern climates. And then finally, heading south, a talk by Don Wallace on fragrant rhododendrons, how you put fragrance in your garden, particularly with the Medenii, but other varieties as well. So a whole range of topics that we think will be of interest to a very broad selection. Now, the really exciting thing from my perspective is that this whole thing is free. This is going to be the first convention where there's no charge to it. Granted, it'll be a virtual convention Zoom, but it's going to be free to everyone. And we even, because it's free, we're expanding it to invite any gardener in the world to attend. So if you've got other garden members who might belong to other societies, Rose, Alpine, Hosta, whatever, you can invite them to participate as well. The only thing that we're asking is that everyone register, and we have a link on how to register. This is so we can send you the link, and if there's any changes or whatever, we can inform you. So we want people to register beforehand. We also need to know how many people are involved, because that determines the size of the Zoom, the Zoom cost that we have to pay to be able to do this. So we need to know that. We can probably take up to 3,000 people if we can get that many, which would be exceptional, because no convention has ever had more than sort of 300 or 400 in a live person involvement. So this is kind of an experiment for the ARS to see just how a virtual conference can work on a big scale.
It sounds very exciting. I am super excited about the fragrant rhododendrons. I'm super excited about the rock garden rhododendron combination. I love rocks. So they're my second love, you know, after plants. Yeah. But I think it sounds very cool. And we're excited to share the information about the conference here. We have talked to a couple of speakers to get previews of what they're going to talk about. And those conversations are going to come up on the podcast right after this conversation great. We're having with you. So
that's great.
Yeah, we're excited to promote it. I hope we do get 3,000. Let's root for 3,000.
Just one other comment, because it's a virtual presentation, you don't have to attend every talk. To sit for 4 hours, we know, is difficult. And if you would like to, of course, that's great. You can choose, and we'll be recording it as well. And so at some point in the future, there may be opportunity to see the recordings, but we hope that people will attend those days. You can be selective on those topics that particularly interest you.
And you can watch the talk in your jammies.
That's true.
You told us about the free part being exciting to you. Is there any subject matter that you are really interested to hear about?
That's a good question. I'm kind of eclectic in my interests. I'm interested really in almost all those aspects. I think what the part that intrigues me the most, though, is the connections between plants and surrounding environment in which they live, in particular, and also just how biodiversity in general and how complex our real world really is. And some of you may have seen the article on bumblebee gardeners, for example, in the last JARS issue, where bumblebees, by nibbling on plants, can actually encourage plants to flower up to 30 days earlier than they normally would. And this helps synchronize the flowering of plants with the bumblebees need to get pollen and so on. And so when you look at the soil talk, for example, and you see the connections between plants and fungi and the microbes and how there's really a complex community down there, and really you should not be tilling your soil because that just destroys this community to a large extent. It takes a while to reestablish. And then Linda Chalker's talk on mulch, and again, how that facilitates this community. So that's just one example of how plants are connected. And they're now finding out that in the wild, different plants of the same species share information on predators affecting them, or herbivores affecting them, like caterpillars, for example. But they're now finding out that plants even of different species have connections, and at the subterranean level. So it's really fascinating just looking at how complex the world is and how easy we as humans can disturb it unknowingly, and the importance for us to try and understand this so that we can get the maximum productivity both for ourselves but also for the animals and creatures that live around us. So I find that personally really exciting. Yeah.
These are really important topics, not just for rhododendron people, but for the rhododendron in the context of, you know, ecology of Earth. So that's very timely.
And if you notice within JARS, I'm trying to spin this a little bit with some of the articles I'm including in JARS, just to make it more than just a rhododendron journal, make it a gardening journal, but also show how rhododendrons are connected with other plants, how they're connected with the natural environment. Because as gardeners, we have a unique opportunity to really influence the communities around us, the animal communities, whether they're butterflies or bees or birds or whatever. We can change things. And with such a large human population in the world, it's really important that we understand this to the extent that we can and try and encourage other creatures to exist along with us.
Yeah, and we can play a role in our garden in conserving biodiversity.
Exactly.
Between the plants that we include and the insects that we encourage, and whether or not we choose to use chemicals or go with something that's more biodiversity friendly, those are all choices that we can make that can make a big difference. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have some Phalaenopsis in the house, and we have some scale insect on them. And I went to buy some neem oil. And neem is a pesticide that's produced from, I believe, the leaves of a plant that's a tree that's grown in India. And what was interesting was that in British Columbia, at least, they now don't sell neem oil in nurseries, because people, it's okay if you use it for household plants, but if you use it within the garden, it can kill bees and other things. So they have banned it, even though it's a natural product. But they are still selling it in health food stores, because apparently it's used on facial creams and stuff. And so you can buy a small 1 ounce for like $15 to put on your face, but you can't buy it in bulk to put in your garden. And I thought this was really interesting. But here's a natural product from trees in India, which is a natural pesticide. It's not something that's chemically produced in a factory. And yet you can't use it, which is great. I think I can understand that. But I was just intrigued to find out you can put it on your face. And I didn't think that was probably the right place to be putting it. But anyway, it's interesting.
So is this toxic before it becomes a commercial product?
It's still toxic for insects if insects are crawling in your face, I guess. I don't know.
No, but the tree that is derived from
it's developed this chemical in it to prevent itself from being eaten by insect or by plant animals that are insects that would eat the leaves of that tree. So it's a natural herbicide.
It's naturally in there.
Yeah, and we have plants in the wild here that have that too. There's plants that grow in the alpine area in British Columbia that you can dry and use as an insecticide. I can't remember the name of it exactly. I think it's wild hellebore or something like that. It's not a hellebore, but it looks a bit like it. Anyway, but this is just an example of a plant that has a natural insecticide in it that can be used in the house, but not outside, in Canada at least.
You can still buy it in Ohio. I have a big jug of neem oil in my garage.
See it? So, yeah. Well, be careful using it outside because it will kill a lot of beneficial insects as well.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I mean, everybody touts it as a natural. And I think the thing to note is natural is not non-toxic.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's plenty of toxic things.
We don't think of that in that context.
Just because when you concentrate a natural insecticide, it can still cause a lot of problems in the wild. And that's the issue here.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting article.
Yeah.
Natural pesticides that are toxic.
Depends what you're trying to kill, I guess.
Yeah.
In all your journey through the rhododendron world, and it's been pretty vast, what is the most interesting thing that you have done for the love of rhododendron?
It's an easy question to answer. The things I've enjoyed most, apart from meeting all the people involved in different aspects of rhododendron and going to the conventions, has been exploration of plants in the wild. And I've been fortunate enough to make two trips to the Himalayas, both with Steve Hoopman and Rhododendron Species Foundation. One 16 years ago to Yunnan, where we traveled, I think about 2,000 kilometers up the Salween Valley, which is a river valley that borders Nepal and heads towards Tibet, and one of the main rivers that comes out of Tibet. And what was interesting about this particular trip was that 15 years ago, China hadn't expanded its economy to the extent it has today. And this was still a pretty remote part of China with a lot of ethnic communities. And we were able to see a part of China that you just can't see anymore, because now that roads have opened up the area and literally millions of Chinese tourists have invaded the area, the whole dynamic of the community has changed. And it's not the same as it was just 16 years ago. You know, people were still wearing the ethnic people were still wearing their traditional dress and so on. But what was most fascinating to me was going up the mountains there, because this is a hot spot of biodiversity for rhododendrons. I think in that particular trip, we saw something like almost 90 species of rhododendrons growing in the wild. And we would have seen more, except they had a huge snowfall that year, and the very high alpine areas were still under literally meters of snow. Wow. So the rhododendrons were still covered. This was in May. What intrigued me was the narrow altitudinal range or elevation range on the mountains that individual species occupied. So as you went up a mountain, you go through different elevation zones, and you might see on any one mountain, maybe 10 to 15 species, but each species would have its own narrow band where it occurred in elevation on the mountains. There'd be alpine species, there'd be species just below the alpine area, there'd be species that down near the bottom, which were more semi-tropical. And so just an appreciation of the range and or the habitats in which these species grow. Now, the reason I mention this is that a lot of these species I grow in my garden. So in my garden at sea level on sandy soil on Vancouver Island, I'm trying to grow alpine plants. I'm trying to grow semi-tropical plants like the Medinia, and the challenge is to try and find microclimates and to understand the habitats in which these plants successfully grow in the wild. And can I even replicate those in the garden? Things like Edgeworthii, a very beautiful species, you only see really growing on epiphytes. They're high up in trees, and they're in the forks of branches and trees. And this is right up almost at the snow line. There'll be snow on the ground below them from avalanches and so on. And so if you're going to grow those in sandy soil, you're not going to have much success. So I always add a huge amount of bark chips and stuff like that to make a woody environment to grow them in. Mm. The other thing is that in North America, or at least where I live, we have a very dry summer and a wet winter, colder, wet winter. In the Himalayas, it's the opposite. They have a dry winter and monsoon rains in the summer and a very wet summer. So here we're trying to grow basically plants that are adapted to a wet summer and dry periods, but at the opposite times of the year that we grow plants. So again, how do you balance this and how do you try and do it? So I try to water as much as I can in the summer, but it's difficult with drought conditions and forest fires and all that around you. And in some cases, you actually have to protect the plants in the winter from the heavy rain we get, because they like to be dry in the winter. Some of the peonia orchids, which grow a lot, for example, with rhododendrons, they like to be dry in the winter. So it's trying to balance this and getting some understanding of the natural habitats Now, when I was in, the other trip I took was just 6 years ago, and that was to Sikkim, India. And that's right up between Bhutan and Nepal and China, right? Squished, this little state that's squished up there. And that was an amazing place too, because just the steepness of the mountains. These are areas that have never been glaciated. They're steep, there's rock slides, there's again, this incredible range and altitudinal diversity. And again, we saw some species the same, but mostly different species. I think we saw about 60 species, 70 species in this area here. And that was just fascinating. Again, the cultural aspects, the mounds we saw, we went right up high in the Alpine on this trip and saw Nivali, which is a tiny, tiny species, only grows about 6 or 8 inches high, tiny little flowers. And what people don't realize is that in the Himalayas, rhododendrons are really the dominant alpine plant. They're the equivalent of heathers in a lot of other places. And that's amazing. And then finally, when I was on the East Coast in the Appalachians, I was taken on a number of trips, not as many as I would have liked, to see the native azaleas growing. And they are truly spectacular too, particularly when they're in fall, when they color, but also in the spring with the flowering. And some of those have very narrow ranges as well. Not so much altitudinally. Here it's more horizontally in terms of latitude. And that's probably because of the glaciation and the effects of distribution after glaciation, after glaciers disappear. They all compressed and then they're expanding their ranges out, sometimes vertically, but sometimes horizontally, or they're left in little isolated pockets of unique habitat. So it's amazing just to see native plants in their own habitats and try to understand how you can now successfully garden these plants in your own garden, which just doesn't have all these natural range of habitats.
That is really amazing, you know, and what a journey, or a number of journeys. But which leads me to ask the question, now that you're fully in love with rhododendron, what led you to rhododendron in the first place?
Yeah, you know, I've always been interested in gardening. My grandfather had a great garden in Montreal when I was growing up, and I asked my parents if I could have a little portion of our property to have my own garden. In university at McGill, I took agriculture, but majored in entomology because although I lived a long way from the ocean, I always wanted to be a marine biologist. The ocean fascinated me. So I majored in entomology. And then when I ultimately got my doctorate, I actually ended up working on crustaceans, which are also arthropods. So it kind of connected with the insect world. But I've always been fascinated by insects and arthropods and animals like that that live around us, crustaceans. So when we moved out west in the early 1980s, actually even before that, I got involved in orchids in Nova Scotia where I was living, because I did find my first job in the marine environment was whaling at a whaling station in Nova Scotia. Oh. So I worked on whales too. And then I got a job with Fisheries and Oceans and when the 200-mile limit was expanded in 1976. And I was involved with the invertebrate community, scallop scientist on the East Coast. And that's when we actually had the first meeting of the Nova Scotia Orchid Society in our house. So I got involved in orchids right up until the early 90s. I had my own business. I was selling, bringing orchids in commercially, going to orchid shows in Vancouver and Seattle and selling them. But orchids are a funny group of plants. There's literally thousands of species and even more diverse than our rhododendrons. But you're trying to grow them all in our climate, at least in a small greenhouse. And it was just getting too complex. And so I got out of orchids and got into rhododendrons, which with 1,000 species are one of the larger complex species too. And that was in 95. And then I could grow in my garden outside. I didn't have to have them inside, except once I got involved in rhododendrons, I found out about Byraeas. And these are the tropical rhododendrons, mostly from Papua New Guinea, Malaysia, Borneo, places like that. And so I did have a greenhouse with tropical rhododendrons, but they're tropical, but not in the same sense as the orchids are, and that they can go right down to zero. They're happy as long as you don't freeze them. So they can stay outside from basically in my climate from April to November. And then some of them you can even keep outside all year round at our climate, but most of them you have to give some protection through the winter. So I bring them in the fall, hold them for four or five months in the greenhouse, then put them back outside. And so it's a nice way to have some tropical plants but not be tied to the, you don't have to heat the greenhouse. All you have to do is keep it above freezing. So, you know, 1 or 2 degrees above freezing, that's all they need, which means a small heat bill. So, and there are about 300 species of Vireas. So it's a fascinating group too. They're often very fragrant. They look totally different from any of the other rhododendrons in your garden. They're tubular. They're just amazing plants. And they'll also flower all year round because they come from the tropics. There's no season. So I've had some Vireas in flower, continuous flower for over 2.5 years. Always sunflowers on them. They've, you know, there's seasons when there's more flowers, but they're just amazing plants. And they range in size from tiny things that you can, about teapot size, to ones that are much bigger, but they lend themselves very well to pot culture. I have to keep most of mine in pots so I can move them around. And you can grow them in the house, but not like orchids. They don't like high temperatures. And the biggest challenge would probably be in the winter with low humidity in many parts of Canada, not so much where I live. But if you keep them down, grow them by low down by a window where the cold air comes off a window, it keeps them cool. And as long as you mist them, they'll probably do fine. And a lot of people, you know, I probably have the biggest collection of Vireas in Canada, but I give a lot of Vireas away and people try them, and it can be quite successful and they can be quite attractive. So that's how I got involved in rhododendrons, and then it's kind of expanded from there.
It's funny how the things that you love come back around. You couldn't get away from those epiphytes, could you?
That's exactly right. Epiphytes are fascinating, yeah.
they're very cool. What a cool life form, a cool life history strategy. Mm-hmm. Just grow on a taller plant. No need to grow tall yourself.
Spoken by a short person.
Yeah. Hey, yep, footstool. There it is.
But it's great to be able to put that information out there to let people know the range of rhododendrons that are available. Mm-hmm. And especially people now who don't have access to a lot of gardens or their own gardens, then here's the Vireas. It's a rhododendron. You can grow it indoors.
That's true. The biggest challenge now, and this is true not just for Vireas, but for a lot of the rhododendrons, is that a lot of the propagators aren't propagating anymore. And I'm not just talking about hybridizers. I'm talking about just how do you get rhododendrons in your garden? And what's happening is that a lot of the big box stores have taken over in places like Costco and all, and they bring plants in from 1 or 2 big production facilities, usually down in California or someplace like that. And the challenge is that you can't get the variety that you used to get, and that it's very difficult to get species. They tend to produce plants that lend themselves to mass production, you know, flower all at the same time. You know, people want big flowers, big yellow flowers or something like that. And you don't see the diversity. And a lot of the people who were hobbyists maybe 10 or 20 years ago are either retiring now or in some cases dying just from old age. But it's very difficult now to get plants. The Bovee's Nursery in the States has closed down. The only real way to probably get Vireas now in the States is out of Hawaii. And even there, the nurseries aren't as common as they were a few years ago. And the other problem that's been encountered is that because of Phytophthora, which is a disease, bacterial disease that can kill plants, moving plants from one area to another is much more difficult. So it's very difficult to get plants coming up from the few hybridizers or nursery growers in the States now, unless they're certified as being clear of disease. And if you do get a plant with the disease, it can really affect your nursery here in Canada. So it's very difficult now to get plants and move them around. And so that's one of the big challenges that's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 20 years is how to get a lot of the plants you want. How we're trying to deal with it on Vancouver Island is that all the chapters are now starting to propagate their own plants. We have a lot of plants in our gardens, a lot of species. We're making inventories of these species and we're propagating them for local distribution within the island, or, you know, not very far away. Obviously, we can send them further, but we aren't really set up to do that. And we're doing this for 2 reasons. One, because on our plant sales, that's where we raise a lot of money to support our chapter. And we need plants to sell. And if we can't get them from local growers, then we have to propagate them ourselves. And also, because we're propagating ourselves, we can propagate the ones that really do well in our area that we know from experience do well and make them available to local gardeners. So there's a number of advantages to doing it. But And there's one other advantage, which I should mention, is that it brings the chapter, the members of a chapter together in the propagation process. So it becomes a social activity that's fun. Doesn't take a huge amount of time, although you do need some space to grow them out to get into a sellable size. But you can often work with local nurseries or garden centers to facilitate that. But that's one of the big advantages. And that's what we're starting to shift into. All the chapters in Vancouver Island are now moving into propagation.
You know, and it's also an opportunity to introduce propagation to younger people who might be interested, who are interested in horticulture, because it's not an overnight process. It's several years process to propagate a plant.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, to be able to take a new generation through that process would be very fulfilling. And then to be able to see the plant thrive, if it's not even in their own gardens, then it's, you know, a garden they can go to.
Yeah.
And still enjoy the plant. So new opportunities.
Yep, and that's a really good point, Christine. And in part to elaborate on that a little bit, we've just established a species garden on Vancouver Island, the Greg Rhododendron Species Garden at Milner Gardens, which is a Vancouver Island University gardening location. And we've now got about 250 species, some of them rare, and we're trying to ensure that they are available because they may disappear in the wild and want to make sure that they're available. So we're working with other nurseries and so on to make sure there's a stock of these plants. But this allows people to see what the rhododendron species look like as opposed to the thousands or zillions of hybrids which occur, because the species are really amazing. And this is where you get hybrids from. You take species, you cross them, you create hybrids. So if you don't have the species, you kind of lost the parent stock for many of our hybrids. So we're doing that. And we have probably the largest species rhododendron garden that's devoted specifically to species rhododendrons on in Canada even. Although, you know, UBC Botanical Garden has a lot of species and they've been around for many years. They aren't showcasing them the same way we are.
Well, this has been a really fun conversation. I really enjoyed hearing your Rhodo origin story, and thank you.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you both very much for doing this. I think that the work you guys are doing is fantastic. So thank you again for all your hard work.
Yeah, yeah,
thank you for
welcome.
That, Glenn.
Yeah, great
care,
to
guys.
Talk to you, Glenn, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yep, thank you very much.
Conference.
Hope to see you at the conference this fall.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you.
All right, so we are here to talk to some of the conference speakers. And we've got our first conference speaker with us. So could you tell us your name and what organizations you're affiliated with?
Yeah, my name is David Sellers, and I used to be affiliated with the American Rhododendron Society for many years, particularly in the 1990s. But at the moment, because my interest has turned to rock gardening, the organizations that I am affiliated with are all rock gardening organizations. So the primary one is the Alpine Garden Club of British Columbia. And I also belong to the North American Rock Garden Society and the Scottish Rock Garden Club.
Ooh, exciting. So I love rock gardens, and rhododendrons and rock gardens are pretty good friends, I would say. So what is even though you're not necessarily in rhodos completely now, what is your area of expertise in rhododendron?
I would say that any expertise I have is really accumulated from growing rhododendrons for the past 35 years. So we began growing rhododendrons because we had quite a large lot. It was just a tree lot with no plants at all except trees. And we removed most of the trees and needed to fill the space. So it so happened, because it's a sloping lot to the north, and because of our climate here in British Columbia, we needed to fill a lot of space. So rhododendron seemed a logical plant to begin with. So we started to grow rhododendrons 35 years ago and got quite involved to the extent that, we went through the normal stages of rhodoholism and started to be more interested in species rhododendrons rather than hybrids. Did a lot of growing rhododendrons from seed. And eventually found that they grew rather large. So became interested in other plants at that point.
My goodness. Mm-hmm. So you didn't venture into hybridizing?
No, did not do hybridizing. Because by that stage, when I was growing from seed, I was pretty much only interested in species rhododendrons. So that was the focus. And there's a lot of interesting species rhododendrons that can be grown from seed.
So were you introduced to rhododendrons because they are so popular and they're all over the place in British Columbia?
Well, I guess so. I'm as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm originally from England in the United Kingdom. And I grew up in the county of Berkshire, not far from Windsor Great Park and the Savile Gardens. And as a boy, we used to go and explore the famous Valley Gardens in Windsor Great Park, which is one of the great rhododendron gardens of the world. So from a very young age, I was acquainted with rhododendrons and always liked them.
Very good. And so what interesting or unusual things have you done for the love of rhododendron?
Oh, well,
anything?
There is one that your listeners will be interested in. And that is in the 1990s, there was a fellow called Peter Wharton, who was the curator of the Asian Garden at the University of British Columbia. And he planned an expedition to China in the fall to collect seed of rhododendrons to add to the UBC Asian Garden. And he contacted a number of rhododendron chapters in the area, and we were very active in the Fraser South Rhododendron Chapter, which is a chapter of the American Rhododendron Society. And the deal was that if we as a rhododendron chapter made a contribution to his, the financial contribution to his expedition, he would bring back seed and share it with us. So we did that. The club contributed to his expedition. When he returned, he gave us lots of seed. The seed was shared out between members. I grew on a lot of that seed, and we now have it in our garden, a number of rhododendrons that are very rare in cultivation because they come from a part of China that hadn't been explored a lot for rhododendrons. So, and one of the interesting things was that because he was there in the fall when the rhododendrons were not in flower, he had to be there in the fall to collect seed, of course. He was not absolutely positive of the identification. So it wasn't until these rhododendrons were grown on and flowered sort of 5, 6, 7 years later that we were able to do a positive identification of which species they were that he had collected.
That is very cool. What is your favorite species that you got from that adventure?
It's probably Rhododendron glanduliferum. It's a very strong, tall growing species with kind of white flowers. It's more like a tree almost. And I have a few of them around the garden now.
Large leaf.
And they're quite big. Oh yeah.
What does the glanduliferum refer to? Gland?
I don't know. As I say, I'm not really a rhododendron person anymore. So you can't ask me two detailed questions.
So what you're saying is, if you get caught by the rhododendron bug, don't worry, you can make it out.
Yes. That is true. I mean, we still have a lot of rhododendrons, as you can imagine. And in my talk, we will be covering a lot of the rhododendrons that we grow, including a lot of the species that we grow.
Oh, perfect. Well, that was my next question, is what's your talk going to be about? So you want to tell us, I know you're going to talk about rock gardens too, right?
Well, the talk is going to be about there's sort of three aspects to it. One is the transition from growing really only rhododendrons to being mostly focused on rock gardening. But there's more to it than that, in the sense that I'm really interested in how you can integrate rhododendrons into a rock garden landscape. I'm not just interested in the alpine plants, but also how the landscape of the rock garden fits into the garden as a whole. And what we have found is that rhododendrons really work very well to frame the overall landscape of a rock garden. Now, of course, you know, we grow dwarf rhododendrons within the rock garden, but then we grow larger species and hybrids outside the rock garden, but it does create really quite an attractive overall landscape picture by having that combination.
So are you using the foliage really as your frame? Is that the aspect that you like?
But it's partly the foliage, yes, of course. I mean, the foliage, that's one of the reasons that we all get interested in species, is because the foliage is so fascinating, the variation in rhododendron foliage. But the rock garden does look really good. I mean, there's a lot of flowering in the rock garden that occurs in late April, early May in this part of the world. And that is also the time when we get a lot of flowering in the rhododendrons in late April, early May, both the species and the hybrids. The species tend to be mostly in April. So there's a lot of really nice color created by color in the rock garden and color in the rhododendron flowers. So it does create a nice picture.
Well, I'm really excited to hear your talk, because that's going to be a fascinating revelation. We are just involved in building a small rock garden, so I'm really excited. Well, now that you know my excitement, or our excitement, what besides your talk are you excited about to discover at the AIRS conference?
There's a couple of talks that I find particularly interesting. One is the trip to Sichuan by Dr. Hartwig Schepka. And I find it always fascinating talks that trace the roots of previous plant explorers. And he's going to be following the route taken by Ernest Wilson in China. And of course, Wilson was introduced many of wonderful rhododendron species from China to the UK. So that's a particularly interesting talk. And the other one that caught my eye was the Southern Appalachian talk, because that's an interesting area of North America, because there are interesting rhododendron and azalea species in that location. And it's an area I don't really know very well. We did have a North American rock garden conference there in that area about 6-7 years ago, and it poured with rain the whole day, so we didn't really see as much as we would have liked. So I'm looking forward to going back to the Southern Appalachians.
It's a beautiful area. It's very unique in its how it looks, and the flora there. It's definitely a strange place for rhodos, because it seems too hot and too tropical a lot of the time. So you're surprised, like, how is this slow growing plant even making a living here? But somehow they find these places that are, I guess, more low quality soil environments, probably.
Right. Yes. So, you know,
yeah.
Rhododendrons don't really like too rich a soil. Right? They like a low nutrient environment. So, I mean, they're basically mountain plants. I mean, I did do a talk once where I talked about the integrating rhododendrons and rock gardening and saying, well, rhododendrons are mountain plants, just like rock garden plants are. So it's quite logical to have the two working together in the same kind of garden. And one of the interesting things about rock gardening is that every species is different and requires different kind of conditions, different kind of cultivation. Mm. You have to think about it. You have to go to the mountains to find out how they grow in the mountains. I mean, when people ask me why I'm interested in growing rock gardening rather than moved away from rhododendrons, one of the reasons is that once you learn how to grow a rhododendron, then you can grow any rhododendron. They're all essentially the same. They don't differ a lot. Once you've really nailed how to grow them, you can grow any of them. Whereas with alpine plants, there's so many different species, so many, you know, you're dealing with, you know, so many different, what's the plural of genuses? Genuses?
Genera.
Genera, sorry, yes, of course. Oh. There's so many different genera, and even among one genus, some of the species require different kinds of treatment. And that's very challenging and interesting and fascinating. And so I think that's probably why, one of the strong reasons why I got interested in rock gardening is because of the challenge of growing so many different genera and species.
That's fascinating, because I think most people would look at growing rhodos as an immense challenge. So, wow, that's very cool that you've leveled up to rock gardens. So I love that.
Yeah, but a bit, you know, you got to remember our climate, notwithstanding the current heat and drought, our climate is very conducive to growing rhododendrons. So it's not difficult to grow rhododendrons here in coastal British Columbia. Mm-hmm. There are not a lot of challenges, and we have a really good access to acidic bark mulch. And that's one of the keys to growing rhododendrons here. Anyway, it is, I use a lot of bark mulch, and it's just great because we put it on rhododendrons and they extend their roots into that even relatively fresh bark mulch. They'll go right into it in this climate. So it's not difficult to grow rhododendrons here. And as I say, once you learn how to grow one, you can grow them all.
That's promising for me. I'm in Northeast Ohio and it's not easy to grow them here, but I've placed all of my faith in acidic bark mulch. So
yeah, what I do is I plant rhododendrons quite shallowly, of course, because they're surface rooters, so that you only need quite a shallow depression to actually plant them in. And so that they end up with being appearing to be on a sort of a mound, like, because you put them in half the root ball goes down into the soil, and I mix bark mulch into the soil as well to increase the acidity and to add, you know, organic matter, low nutrient organic matter. So you half of the root ball goes down, half of the root ball is, or maybe a third is slightly raised above the surface. But then if you can imagine, if you're planting two or three rhododendrons, you've got, they all appear to be on slight mounds, but then you come in and you bark mulch the hell out of the whole thing, so that you end up with pretty much a level surface, right? Because you have to be careful not to put too much bark mulch around the stems, because the stems can rot. So by filling in the kind of depressions between the rhododendrons, you end up with a nice, you can end up with a sort of a level garden with very thick bark mulch in it, and the rhododendrons shallowly rooted, and then they push their roots out into that bark mulch. They love it.
Well, I'm going to do a redo. I've got 15 species in my garden. They've done okay. I planted them last year, and I'm going to do a redo. And this year, I'm going to pull them up a little bit. I think I planted them a little too deep, and I did not have enough acidity. So they're still alive. So we'll keep trying. Anyway, I feel like this has been a really fun conversation.
It really has.
Yeah, it's been fun meeting you. I always get excited when I meet another species person, because so many people are just into hybrids. So,
Well, you know, it's too bad that we couldn't be meeting you in person, because that would be just such a pleasure to sit over a glass of wine or dinner or whatever we're doing and having these discussions and conversations. It's too bad, but perhaps in the future that opportunity will come.
Yeah, maybe. I have spoken to the Ontario Rock Garden group. They meet at the Toronto Botanical Garden on Sundays. And when we were flying back and forth, I've been there a couple of times to talk to them. If this pandemic ever ends, I may end up talking in Toronto.
I'll be sure to buy passage.
My name's David Millay, and I run a business called Millay Nurseries that my father set up in 1970. And until a couple of years ago, I was also chairman of the Rhododendron Camellia and Magnolia Group, which is affiliated to and part of the Royal Horticultural Society. So I was chairman for 5 years, and I'm now vice chairman. And I'm also on the RHS Woody Plant Committee. So, I'm been quite busy with that life, sorting things out and helping to promote rhododendrons, camellias and magnolias through the British Isles. The business I run is Millay Nurseries. As I said, I started by my father in 1970, and we grow the best part of 900 different varieties of rhododendron, which makes us one of the largest growers of rhododendrons, I suspect, in the world in the variety stakes, but we grow a lot of varieties, rare species, modern hybrids, old hybrids. And we sell those mainly online nowadays. So we've got a plant centre here that people come and visit. We've got 5 acres of gardens, trials gardens and ornamental gardens. But particularly with COVID around, our internet sales have been huge. And that's the way most of our business is selling. We were selling all through Europe, but with Brexit, it's mainly the England and Scotland nowadays. So that's a little bit about me.
So David, you have such a treasure trove of history behind you. So what actually brought you into rhododendron interest? Was it just a seamless progression from, you know, inheriting it from family, or is it something, you know, a little bit more from your own experience and background that got you into it? And then I have another question.
Should I do that one first? Growing up, I didn't have much to do with the business at all. I went into commercial horticulture. I studied commercial horticulture, and I worked at big nurseries. I mean, Hillier Nursery is one of the most famous nurseries in the country, here in this country. Hillier Nursery is down at Winchester, and I was there as a student, and then I worked on a big seed nursery as well. And then I ran a big nursery down in Dorset for 6 years as well. And I always said I was never going to have anything to do with rhododendrons. I mean, they were not what I wanted to do. Being in a teenager and early 20s, I was much more interested in trees and shrubs. Rhododendrons just didn't do it for me. And in fact, it was the sort of light bulb moment came when I went to America, in fact, because I was quite an active member of the International Plant Propagator Society. And Bruce Briggs, who Briggs Nurseries in Olympia, Washington State, was also an active member. And I knew he was coming across to a conference in England that I was attending. And I wrote to him and said, look, is there any chance of me coming to work for you? I just wanted to work abroad. After my college training, I always said I wanted to work abroad, but this good job came up for me in the UK, and it was never possible. So finally, after nearly 30, I sort of thought, right, I really want to get this sort of travel bug out and to go and work in the States. And I met Bruce, and he said, yep, come across and work for him. So that was great. And of course, he was rhododendrons, and it was just the one person I knew through the International Plant Propagator Society happened to be rhododendrons. And it was while having a season in Washington State, all around Seattle, at the Rhododendron Species Foundation. I've had a short internship there as well, and working with the new hybrids and the meeting members of the ARS, that I suddenly realized I had an interest in rhododendrons. And having planned to be out in the States for several years, just one spring and one season out there basically made me realize that there was something in there for rhododendrons for me. And I came back relatively soon. I loved my time in America, but I came back relatively soon and took over the business from my father, who was 70 at that time. And I just couldn't believe, you know, my father was surprised, I was surprised, and it all worked out fine, but it was not what I'd planned. So that was really what got me into rhododendrons. And he'd started the business. It was a relatively small hobby business for him and his him and my mother. And at the same time, my elder brother also needed to, he was working on the farm here, and that wasn't going well. So the pair of us took over from my parents and developed Millay Nurseries into this much bigger nursery that it is today.
What a story.
Yeah.
You know, we can all relate to pieces of that. You know, how we did come to meet rhododendron and fall in love, as it were.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's really interesting. So what I'd also like to know is, what is an interesting or an unusual thing that you've done for the love of rhododendron?
Well, yeah, that's another good, is a good, another good story behind that one as well, because I'm sure it's the same in America as well. When we want to export plants, we have to have them inspected by a ministry plant health inspector. And we had a really good plant health inspector back in the late 80s and early 90s. He suggested that I might join him on a trek he was going to go and do in Nepal. I thought that sounds interesting. And it was an area I'd never been to before. It was the Himalayas, it sounded great. And it was going to be a plant exploration trek to an area of Kanchenjunga, the northeast corner of Nepal, which at that stage had only just been opened up to tourism. And I knew it was going to be quite an energetic trek, because we were away for 4 weeks and away from any road or vehicle for more than 3 weeks. So we were quite remote. And we saw, I think it was 26 out of the 31 rhododendron species growing in Nepal during that time. But the main thing that that trek produced for me was, I managed to bring back some seed, some rhododendron seeds. So that's always nice, and found some nice new forms of various different plants from Nepal that we're still growing here in the garden now. So that's nice. But we were away, as I said, from any habitation for 3 or 4 weeks. And so we took a trek doctor with us. I ended up marrying Susanna, so that was that was a great thing all around, really. So Susanna was our Trek doctor, and we suddenly found that we had some things in common. And she had been working in Nepal for 2 or 3 years and came back soon after this trip with me. And she did a master's in London, and we got to know each other, and we were married within the year, basically. So there we are. That was 28 years ago now.
Love in the rhododendrons.
Love in the rhododendron mountains. Wow. Yeah.
That is so, what a beautiful memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's strange. It's not just Susanna and I that met in Nepal. My brother was also working in Nepal at that time as a hydro engineer, and he met his wife in Nepal as well. So it's strange life. There we go.
Wow. So can you tell us a little bit about what your talk's going to be about at the conference?
Conservation is something we need to be very aware of, because, I mean, there are 30,000 registered rhododendrons. There are 600 to 800 species, depending how you count them. They're going to get lost. You know, there are young generations coming through without the same interests as us. I'm not saying they should have the same interests as us. And in fact, you know, maybe they should, some of these varieties deserve to be lost, but there are some incredible varieties. There are some incredible species that are going to get lost if we're not careful. And I think I'm just going to be talking about, you know, how you decide which plants are going to be, which plants are worth trying to save, trying to get different, better forms selected, and better forms saved before they're either lost through a garden. I mean, we're all very entranced, you know, we're very sort of, we're only on this life for perhaps 80 years, perhaps gardening for 20 or 30 years in reality. Plants, a decent rhododendron should last for 100 years or more. But if it's not looked after, it's going to die. And we're very transient. We need to be looking after these plants. And, you know, people have gone to a lot of trouble to collect them from the Himalayas. Collectors like Forrester, George Forrest and Kingdon Ward. They brought them back. We've got them growing in our gardens, but they will die out if they're not looked after. And so there's that side of things. And then there's also the deforestation in the Himalayas. And you can't blame that on the local people, because sometimes they just want firewood. But, you know, it's a fact that the situations in the Himalayas, that they're getting lost, plants are getting lost. So how do we save those? And I think that's an important question. It can be solved relatively simply by working together. And I'm quite certain this is where groups such as the American Rhododendron Society and the Rhododendron Camellia Magnolia Group and other groups around the world can really come up with a program so that these plants are saved, whether that be a interesting species or, you know, a relatively modern or ancient hybrid. They can all be saved, but it's got to be done systematically. It's got to be done in conjunction with others. It's got to be done where places, you can't have just one depository. You know, one plant is not safe. You've got to have a range of plants in a range of different gardens, a range of different climates, so that they can be saved. And there are challenges, and they can be met. And I'm going to be talking about that sort of thing. One of the examples, we've got several examples I can use. If you go down to Cornwall in England, the far southwest, there's a lot of rhododendrons called Cornish Red. That every good rhododendron garden down there has got a plant there called Cornish Red. They're all different. They're all agrex. And I was keen to put into our production a Cornish Red. So you ask around until you find, look, you know, where is the best Cornish Red? And people have got different views on it. This is, it's basically, it's an arboreum hybrid. So it's a tall growing plant, suitable for big gardens only. And I found what was generally acknowledged to be the best Cornish red in a National Trust garden called Trellisic. It's a lovely garden. And they kindly gave us some scions, and we grafted them, and we got those plants growing quite easily. 2 years later, that tree, which must have been nearly 80 to 100 foot tall, blew over in a storm, dead, gone. And, you know, you just think that is not the only, and you know, I can give several examples like that, where we have propagated something and the next year or so, its plant is gone and dead. And you know, this is just tragic. It can be tragic, but, you know, there's a good story to hear, because, you know, we've got that plant in the garden. We've got it in commerce. We've given those plants back to Trellisic Gardens. Easy, job done. Another one that a lot of people know, the Exbury Gardens, world famous 200 acre garden. And I've been at them for several years to say, look, you know, you're not propagating your plants. Some of their plants they've raised way back for the last 60 years, and they've named them, they've got awards for them, and they weren't propagating them. And I said, you cannot rely on just that one plant. And finally, the trustees of the garden accepted that it would be a good idea to propagate them. I think they were very worried about losing their genetic resource, and they didn't want to lose their key varieties. And over this probably a time frame of about 15 years, we've been working with Exbury Gardens, propagating probably about 15 or 20 varieties each year. Doesn't sound a lot, it's easy to do, but over 15 years, that's 250 varieties that we have propagated and saved. And you know, they've had them back. We've put some of them into production, but this all comes back to conservation. What they want for their gardens would be a different plant to what other people want for their gardens. It would be a different plant from what I would want to put commercially into production in the nursery. So everyone's got different views, but, you know, we've now saved 250 varieties out of Exbury that were on the verge of getting lost. And that's great to be doing. And it's great to be offering those 250 varieties to our customers over the sake of 15 years. You know, these things can be done really quite easily, but it does need some coordinated work. And this is, you know, this is where these societies can come in and make a difference.
It's really important. Really, yeah, it's important work. Very important.
Yeah.
Saving the genetic diversity in terms of species, hybrids, and then connecting that to the things that people care about is really the only way it's going to work. Yeah. So I love the collaboration between your business, a botanical garden, and then getting that out to people's gardens. Each one of those plants, it has a chance. And so
it has a chance. Yeah.
That's really, really
cool. You know, you have to make some choices, and you know, not everything's worth saving. This 30,000 rhododendrons are not worth saving. I'm just to get my book out here. This book here was written by my great uncle in 1924. This is the second series. The first one was in 1917. So I never met this man. My father never, he died in 1930. My father would have only been a very small boy at this stage, but it was because of this family interest in rhododendrons that my father got interested, and therefore presumably me. But you can read in the book about in 1924 about how my great uncle J.G. Millay reckoned that I think he said something, you know, 80% of the hybrids bred before 1900 were rubbish. You know, things things move on, and we'd have to accept that, but there are plants that are worth saving, and we just need to sort them out and save them.
When you spend 5 or 10 years waiting for a plant you bred to bloom, I guess I can see how you get really attached to each and every one. But
that's something else we do is actually breeding rhododendrons. I mean, but there's no money in it. But it's, you know, I only here we are in August, and I found we got a really nice rhododendron serotinum, and we got a which is white and scented, and I also had flowering a pink one called Europa. And I thought, right, let's see if we can breed those together. But, you know, that's going to be a 10-year cycle before I can even name a plant. So I'm, you know, it's a long-term process. But that's another story altogether. That's not so much conservation.
But also a fascinating one. Perhaps we'll catch you next time.
I love the family history. It's very, it's appealing to me because sometimes we have to work to carry on a legacy.
Yes.
And I see that you're doing that. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the mainstays of the Next Gen program for the American Rhododendron Society is the focus on conservation and specifically getting younger people involved in it. Let them see how important it is to preserve the species and the hybrids that we have. You know, so a talk, the talk that you're going to give hopefully will have an impact in that direction. With the
It's great that you're setting that as an agenda, you know, for the next few years and to, you know, hopefully to bring some young people in and getting them involved, because it is a long-term project. I mean, you know, we've been doing this work with Exbury Gardens for 15 years. It doesn't seem like very long to me at all, but you know, it's just nibbling away at these key varieties, and you know what they wanted was to get their stock propagated, and they, you know, we've done that for them. Mm-hmm. What I wanted was to see if there were some commercial varieties, and there were, but you know what they wanted to save might have been suitable for them, but some of the varieties were prone to powdery mildew or something like that, and you know, I wouldn't want to touch them again. But you know, you've got to start from somewhere. And yes, you'll propagate some varieties that you'll save some varieties. But you know, are they right for the long term? Possibly not. But you can get them distributed and saved and moved around the country. That's all great.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a very interesting talk, and I know that people will be looking forward to it.
Well, I hope so.
Well, we've really had fun talking to you. It was great to meet you.
Great
to hear about Malay Gardens. I would love to come and visit someday, so I'm putting it on my bucket list.
Yeah. Great.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right.
All right. Great. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Speak soon.
See you in a few weeks. Bye for now.
Next time on For the Love of Rhododendron, join me, Connor Ryan, and Christina Woodward for a conversation with Paul Chafe, professor at St. Lawrence College in Ontario, Canada, and rhododendron hybridizer in his spare time. We discuss the science and art of plant breeding, Paul's breeding program in the frigid north, and rhododendron horticulture from a Canadian perspective. Paul is a millennial and has a wealth of knowledge to share about plants and horticulture. And this episode comes just in time for seed harvest from this year's crosses. See you in October.
Curious to learn more about the topics discussed in this episode? Visit our website at www.rhododendron.org. Here, you'll find tons of rhododendron resources, including tutorials, blogs, events, databases, and more. Click on the podcast link on the homepage to find more episodes, suggest a topic for a future episode, and get in-depth information about the people, places, and plants featured here. Until next time, keep carrying that torch for rhododendron, and don't forget to talk endlessly about this podcast to all your friends and family.